So without further ado, Shep Dolman will tell us about... Shep Dolman will tell us about the Event Horizon Telescope in brief.
Can everybody hear me? Is this on? Excellent. Okay. Well, thank you for those kind remarks, Neil and Avery. It's a real pleasure to be here to address this particular crowd about the Event Horizon Telescope. It's an exciting project, and I think we're here to make some substantial progress on it. And simply put, we're trying to make an Earth-sized interferometric array that links radio telescopes around the globe to make the Earth a telescope that can resolve, both in space and in time, the event horizon of a black hole. And it sounds simple to do, but it involves the hard work of a lot of people, most of whom are in this room, so let's not hope for a catastrophe. And it involves a broad attack on a number of different science themes. And it's really reflected in the talks that you'll see here today. There are talks that are heavy on mathematics, heavy on physics, including quantum physics, and of course, very heavy on astronomy. And we're asking the big questions. And we're able to do that because there is this cross-hatched area in the Venn diagram between math, physics, and astronomy where black holes naturally lie. In mathematics, we can ask questions about the stability of the Kerr metric that uses elliptical functions and so forth, very heavy math. Then there's quantum mechanics from physics and the information paradox, which is one of the most interesting questions one can hope to ask and answer about the nature of our universe. And then, of course, there's accretion physics and understanding how black holes feed. And we can ask, is there an event horizon? Is Einstein right? You know, how do we get matter into and away from the region of a black hole? Do they have spin? How do they launch these magnificent jets to give us feedback? And what is the quantum nature of black holes? And can we observe those on event horizon scales? So we start off by asking ourselves, well, can we get to the event horizon? What would we see when we got there? And as early as the 70s, people were showing fairly accurately that there's a shadow that will form when you get close to the black hole due to strong gravitational lensing. And this is remarkable, I think. The diameter of that shadow, if the black hole is not spinning, is the square root of 27 times some fundamental constants. And as I've said before, this is the hardest way to measure the square root of 27 you will ever proceed to do in your entire life. Do not build an Earth-sized array of telescopes to do this. Use a calculator. And the size and shape of that shadow encodes GR. There's a lot of work being done by people in this room to see if we can test GR using this. And I'm happy to report that Hollywood has finally caught up with the work that is being done in this field. Kip Thorne and others have taken some of these gravitational lensing routines and shown us an interstellar that Hollywood can actually send a spaceship back in time, you know, all that stuff. But they're getting the GR right. And in a variety of different contexts here, radially inefficient accretion flows, relativistic magneto-hydrodynamic flows, you see the shadow feature. Right, and this shadow feature is about 5 Schwarzschild radii across. That's the angular resolution that we're targeting. And this tends to show up, this circular feature tends to show up no matter how you light up the space-time with your 3D flashlight. In addition, matter does its own singular dance close to the black hole. It's very unintuitive. But if you're in a prograde orbit around the black hole, you can go all the way up to the last, you know, Schwarzschild radii close to the black hole. But if you're in a retrograde orbit, you're bound to orbit 9 Schwarzschild radii away. That's a factor of 10. And if we can focus in on that region, we could ask some really interesting questions and answer them about the nature of relativistic jet genesis. Now, let's focus on the prime target of the Event Horizon Telescope, one of the prime targets, Sagittarius A star. We're gonna hear a lot about some of these results, but there are amazing results coming from Andrea's group and others on the orbits of stars around Sag A star. It's clear that there's an unseen mass there. In the infrared, we see these bumps and wiggles, but stars in the background are constant, telling us there's something very small there. And you see the same thing with these very short rise times in the X-ray. So it's small, very, very massive. It's our best candidate black hole. And the spectrum peaks right where we'd like it to peak for very long baseline interferometry in the submillimeter here. And if you're going to go looking for the black hole in the center of the galaxy, that's exactly where you want to look for it, because these photons can pierce the ionized medium between us and the center of the galaxy. Now, how are we going to do this? Well, we're going to use very long baseline interferometry, turning the Earth into a telescope. And we do this simply by collecting data at remote sites, time stamping them with atomic clocks, and then bringing them together at a central correlation facility to synthesize Fourier visibilities that we can invert and make images or models of the sky. Now, the resolution you get is astounding. When we move to 0.8 millimeters on global baselines, we'll get 20 microarcseconds. And the shadow size we're after is 50, so we're dramatically resolving the shadow size for Sag J star. And we go to these short wavelengths because we do need to see through the ionized material between us and the galactic center. At lower frequencies, the shadow is obscured and blurred because of this scattering effect. So we made our first successful observation back in 2008, and on these long baselines to Hawaii from the continental United States, we resolved dramatically Sagittarius A star. So you see on the short baselines, you recover a lot of the energy of the source. On the long baselines, you resolve it. And you can fit a nice Gaussian size to this, which is about 4 Schwarzschild radii across. So this was the moment when we thought, we can do this. You know, all the predictions that have been made, they can probably be examined in great detail. The density here is just phenomenal. It's equivalent to 4 million times the mass of our sun within the orbit of Mercury. So it's very, very strong evidence for the black hole, corroborating evidence for it. And regarding the scattering, I want to pay respects and homage to a long line of intrepid explorers, and we're just the last in this line, that have explored this lambda squared scattering law, because Sagittarius A star was basically just a point source scattered by the interstellar medium for a long time. And it's only through the efforts of Jeff Bauer, Thomas Kritschbaum, and these new results here, we've begun to see deviations from this lambda squared curve. So we're getting to a point where we're not limited by scattering, where the fundamental structure is emerging from this blurring effect. Now, M87 is our other prime target, and you can see it is a much different beast. So we have two really interesting objects in the wheelhouse of our portfolio. This shows a 6.6 billion solar mass black hole with a relativistic jet here. And we performed the same kind of trick with three baselines, and we found a size of 5 Schwarzschild radii, 5.5. If you ascribe that size to the innermost stable circular orbit that is thought to launch that jet, and that's where the temperature peaks and where charged particles are most easily put onto the jet to light up, then you can say something very interesting about the spin. Because the apparent ISCO diameter, and I say apparent because it has to be gravitationally lensed, changes from retrograde orbits to prograde orbits here. Now, this is our size, and this is our 1 sigma error bar on the size. So if you say when we measured the ISCO, then we're telling you, well, it has to be about 0.6 spin or higher. Right, so the key thing here is that you have to use strong GR effects even to begin to interpret your data. These are the size scales that we're probing with the EHT now. Now, what's next? Over the next 2 to 3 years, there's great promise for what we're going to do together as a group. We're going to increase the number of stations from the 3 to 8, and since the baseline number goes as n squared, we're almost increasing the number of baselines by a factor of 10. The bandwidth increase due to Moore's law is going to increase to 16 gigahertz. The collecting area is going to go up by a factor of 10 as soon as we bring ALMA online. I'll talk to you about that in a moment. The impact is very strong because the sensitivity increase is going to be a factor of 40. This brings in the longest baselines to the South Pole. And these are remarkable in their angular resolution. The full closure phase information we'll get will allow modeling and imaging. The polarization information we get will let us tease out magnetic fields at the event horizon. And with the time domain, with all the sensitivity we get, we'll be able to analyze trends on 10-second timescales, looking at orbits of matter around the black hole. So here we are. We've done observations on this small, slender triangle. We were lighting up the LMT this year, ALMA and APEX this year. The European telescopes are coming online. And Dan Moroney is taking his intrepid crew down to the South Pole to light up the South Pole in January. And in addition, Greenland Telescope, which you can't see here because this is Sag J star's view of the HD, is going to come online in the future. And that's being run by Asia A. So just a few tidbits to let you know that there are people in the field working on this. We took a new hydrogen maser to the LMT in Mexico. Now, if you have never experienced hand winching a $250,000 atomic clock up a spiral staircase on a slender cable, I recommend it highly. But not if you have a heart condition. And this is Gisela Ortiz, one of the Mexican graduate students who helped us adjusting the maser, and we got wonderfully strong fringes at 3 millimeter wavelength between the LMT and our partner sites. in the VLBA. So this site is ready to go, and we're working on a 1.3 millimeter receiver to allow it to join the EHT. The kind of UV coverage we get when you add the LMT really begins to fill out in red here, parts of the Fourier plane, allowing us to begin to think for the first time about making true images. Phasing ALMA is the next big thing. It is the single most important objective for us. It increases our resolution by a factor of 2 and sensitivity by 10, and I just want to point out that this is truly an international effort. Everybody is coming together in order to phase up all 64 of these dishes to make an effective 85-meter dish. This just shows some preliminary results we had. 11 stations in ALMA were not phased, and we turned on the phasing loop, and they came into perfect synchronization here. And this was in horrible weather, by the way. So we think that in nominal weather for ALMA, we'll be able to extend these 3-millimeter results to 1.3 millimeter, and that's ongoing. Now, what allows us to swallow all this bandwidth and get the extra sensitivity? Well, thank you to Moore, right? We have accelerated along this Moore trajectory in terms of gigabits per second that we can record. And the more data you record, the more sensitive the VLBI array is as a function of time here. We started with magnetic tapes, and we increased the fidelity of those systems accordingly. And then we ran into a physical limitation on the tapes. And we were able to jump to disks. And now with proprietary hardware, and now we are on this COTS trajectory, a commercial off-the-shelf trajectory, we buy our systems from Dell. And we write custom software to make them work. So now we are recording on banks of hard disk drives and using FPGAs, solid-state technology, to go from 128 megabits per second to 16 gigabits per second. And our target is 64 gigabits per second. That's what allows us to take these relatively small millimeter dishes, because they have to be smooth, and get all the sensitivity we need by expanding greatly the bandwidth that we record. Now, this has allowed us to get closure phases. These are the sum of interferometric phases around a closed triangle of VLBI baselines, a fundamental key observable for imaging, and make complex models of the inner jets of quasar calibrators that we observe during our EHT runs. And this phase information is set to explode. This is a wonderful animation by Laura Berdichich, who's an SAO postdoc, that shows that for M87, you get many, many baselines simultaneously around the globe as a function of time. So the phase information we can recover is at the 70 to 80% level. This is going to allow us to make true images of the strong GR effects near M87, for example. This is work by our postdoc, who is now at Max Planck Institute, Rusen Liu, who couldn't be with us here. But he's taken these GR models that the Avery Broderick has pioneered, and you see clearly this shadow here. With the full EHT array, you get a fairly good fidelity image, even accounting for thermal noise. And if you lose one of the stations in the US, you can still recover that shadow feature. And there are some other combinations. We'd like not to lose ALMA, for example. But even some of the other important stations, we may be able to, over time, overcome the loss of one station during one epoch, and then come back and continue to image. So they're really wonderful prospects, and we'll be hearing about this from John Monnier, because he's pioneer optical algorithms that are he's been working on. The other big thing is deblurring. Now, I told you that we were seeing through the scattering. That's not entirely true. Scattering is now subdominant. But the problem is that if you take one of these wonderful images or models that Avery has come up with, and you blur it through the interstellar medium, you wash out some of this lovely shadow feature. Okay, you can still see something very small, but you lose some of the GR testability. And if you try to image that with the Event Horizon Telescope, you can faithfully reproduce that. But what we're working on now, and Vincent Fish has worked on this, and Michael Johnson will talk about this on Friday, is use a deconvolution technique to de-blur, because we know how the interstellar medium is blurring Sagittarius A star. And when you do that and you install that algorithm, you can start to recover very well that shadow. So this is one of the key problems that we've had to face, and we're working on it and making some very good progress, I think. Now, then the time domain. This is a great animation that Avery put together some time ago that shows that if you have a hot spot orbiting the black hole, you get these secondary, even tertiary images showing up. You get these asymmetries, which lead to non-zero closure phases as a function of time. And here's the kicker. GM over C cubed for Sagittarius A star is about 10 seconds. So we need to be able to resolve 10-second timescales to resolve orbits. And the ISCO orbit for Sag A star, the innermost stable circular orbit, is 4 minutes if it's, oh, it's 4 minutes if it's going very fast, and half an hour if it's zero spin. And you can see that the EHT is going to be able to follow that closure phase signature of that periodic function shown here in red, and simulation is shown here in black points with exquisite signal-to-noise ratio. So when we get to our 64 gigabit per second benchmark, we'll be able to follow the time variable structure around Sagittarius A star on sub-orbital timescales. Now, it's going to be much more complicated than that. This is a wonderful animation by Josh Dolenz and Charles Gammy, which shows that we're not going to have hot spots orbiting Sagittarius A star, but the signal-to-noise ratio we're going to get is enough to begin to tease out turbulence in this flow. What a wonderful result that will be to verify there's turbulence in an accretion flow with potential impact on studying the magnetorotational instability. And what about magnetic fields? We know that magnetic fields are absolutely critical for all mechanisms that extract energy from black holes. They mediate all of these mechanisms. And we expect there to be ordered fields because they can shear or they can be compressed in this way. But we expect to see magnetic fields increase as we come towards the event horizon. And without stealing too much thunder, Michael Johnson is going to talk about this, I think, later today, we are finding a very strong evidence for ordered magnetic fields at the event horizon. So this shows as a function of U and V, these are baselines. So each point here represents a baseline pair. And you can see that the fractional polarization on some of these scans gets to 60 or even 70%, and that's near the synchrotron limit. So we're seeing ordered fields of the magnitude that we would expect very close to the black hole. And this is going to allow us, I think, with the full EHT, to map magnetic fields very close to the black hole boundary. And some work being led here by Avery and Dimitrios at University of Arizona and others is asking whether we can test GR itself. Taking the no-hair theorem, in which the quadrupole moment of the black hole is expressed by the spin and the mass only, and adding this twiddle factor. And as you turn that twiddle factor knob, essentially changing the metric of space-time, you change where the innermost stable circular orbit is and how light is bent around the black hole. And this leads directly to changes in the image that we expect to see. Now, if these changes are large enough, we could use EHT data to discriminate between them. And that's what Avery and colleagues has done here. He's looked at the inclination of the model that he uses as a function of epsilon and attempted, or he has the framework, to say which of these models is the most likely. Now, unfortunately, you can't discriminate amongst the epsilon models currently, but with more and more EHT data, we expect to localize these kinds of models to the point where we might be able to say whether GR is correct or not based on this parameterized model. So where are we going? I'm happy to say that there is broad progress technically and scientifically across the entire array. We have fringes to APEX in Chile. We have our successful VLBI test of the LMT. The Greenland plans are underway to send a telescope there. South Pole, I'm sorry I can't go, but there are many in this audience who are going, is going to be lit up this January. And ALMA should be ready by early 2015 for initial tests. Our partners in Europe, our collaborators in Europe, are working on IROM 30 meter in Plateau de Bure. JCMT has been rescued. It was on the chopping block, but has been rescued by an East Asian collaboration. The SMA is getting a new phased array back end. Everything is kind of coming up fringes. And we received a very nice NSF Mid-Scale Innovations Program award for operations and all the remaining technical build-out over the next 5 years. So everything is in place to get the entire Event Horizon Telescope up and working. And this just shows you that when we talk about Earth-sized arrays, we really mean Earth-sized arrays. This is the SMA and our detection to Chile on a calibrator. It is a wonderful collaboration across the globe that's making this possible, from Europe to East Asia to Chile to the United States. And these are the funding agencies that have made contributions so far to the EHT. And we're thankful to all of them and for their support. I want to remind everybody that we were together, some of us together, in 2012. We were a little bit younger, maybe a little bit more naive. But things have progressed well. This is a conference that we held in Tucson that was run by Dan Moroni and Dimitrios Saltis that got us all together for the first time. And this is the second in those conferences. So in summary, DHT has become real. It's been enabled by precursor observations, and we're nearing technical readiness. I think that within 3 years, we'll be making credible imaging runs and trying to resolve orbits in time, and the instrumentation is funded. There are challenges, which I hope we can discuss during this meeting. Some sites are under pressure naturally with the emergence of ALMA, and we'll have to talk about how to rescue other sites. And there are key community discussions to have. And at this conference, I'm looking forward to a broad discussion on EHT science, review and plan technical elements, and talk about the organizational issues. There's a lot to do, and it's a very, very exciting time. And when you can visit us here. Thank you very much.
Thank you, sir.